We have the pleasure to have Christoph Stefan from the University of Potsdam, and he will teach us many nice things about non-commutative geometry a la con.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks a lot, Michael, for inviting me over. Just for one talk. So, I'm really impressive institute. European universities. I'm sitting in a shack, actually. That's the only bistro. Just one corner.
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay. Yes. I will try to give a very brief and quick introduction into non-commutative geometry in the sense of con. It's in the sense, I say it's in the sense of con because there are quite a lot of different varieties of non-commutative geometry on the market. And the sense of the non-commutative geometry con developed is based on an algebraic formulation of geometry, which mainly involves Dirac operators and algebras as a basis instead of manifolds. And it's an algebraic version of differential calculus, if you like. So I will begin with a quick and dirty overview, just to settle a little bit the terrain. Then I'll tell you a little bit about the actual math, so the geometry, and then how to do physics with it. And then at the end, a tiny little bit of the most prominent thing, which is the standard model and how it comes out in a way in non-commutative geometry. And then a few conclusions. So, to begin with, our aim is, of course, the aim of everybody around to unify general relativity and the standard model of particle physics. We want to do it on the same geometrical level. So what I mean by that, I'll tell you in a minute. What we cannot do is to quantize everything. So we don't do quantum gravity. Everything is set here. It's set as a classical field theory. So you have to quantize afterwards, which means we cannot do quantum gravity, or as most people here, of course, people can do it, but we don't know how to do proper quantum gravity. So when you quantize the outcoming theory, you throw away all the gravity bits and just quantize the standard model stuff, and that's how, in our theory, quantum comes in for the moment. We hope we can do better in the future. So a very schematic overview, how I see general relativity. I see gravity as some sort of pseudo force associated to space-time symmetry. So I just get me the hockey stick. So what we have on one side space-time, which is a dynamical entity. I mean, I don't tell anybody anything new. We have the space-time symmetries, which is the diffeomorphisms of your space-time, which act on space-time. To do physics, we have gravity, which is encoded in the Einstein-Hilbert action, which is left invariant by the diffeomorphisms, and which in turn then gives dynamics to space-time. What we want to achieve is exactly the same thing for the standard model. Here we know a little bit. We know that we have the gauge symmetries as the symmetry group, which is for standard model the well-known U1 times SU2 times SU3. They leave invariant some standard model action, which is just the Young-Mills-Hicks action functional. And what we want to have is something we can put in here for space. We want a space-time where these gauge symmetries are the symmetries of, as the diffeomorphisms are of normal space-time. We know usually there are theorems which stand exactly against that. But in non-commutative geometry, by reformulating everything, one can do better. One wouldn't find something like an ordinary manifold which could take the place here. One way one can, of course, go is go via principal bundles and so on, and so extra structures on space-time. But we really want to do everything, we want to have everything as as some sort of a space time. And the main idea I will pursue here is the idea of CON, and that is to find an algebraic formulation of geometry, which is given by a spectral triple. So instead of looking at the manifold itself, you look at the functions over the manifold. You need a Dirac operator, and you need a Hilbert space where everything is represented on. And then you see that the equivalent to the symmetries of your manifold, the diffeomorphism, is just the automorphisms of this algebra of function. And for this Dirac operator, you can write down an action function, which is a spectral action by Chamsuddin and Kohn. I will come to the details later. And then you see that you can push in here this algebraic layer and have, in principle, the same structure you have for general relativity. There's one real problem yet, which we hope also we can overcome in the future. We can only do Euclidean signatures. So there are I know of no sensible way to write down a spectral triple in Lorentzian signature. That would be definitely something we would need. And also the spectral action, you will see later, is only well defined in Euclidean signature. So one would need a sensible replacement for that as well. But for the moment, Euclidean works only. So one has to do all the calculations and then hope that one can rotate the end. Yeah? The problem is you need a positive definite scalar product, and that's one main ingredient which comes in many places in the proofs, and so then with a Lorentzian signature you fail there. And there are other subtleties. I'm not actually an expert on these Lorentzian spectral triples. There are people working on it, Mario Paschke and Rainer Ferch and Adam Rennie. They're trying to do something, and I think André Sitas also. But apparently at the moment, there isn't even a good starting point how to do it. So. Yes. Yes. Yeah. I know. I know that's a big problem. That's a big, yeah, that's the biggest problem. I don't think we are locked in. I think we don't know how to do it better yet. I think it's possible, but at the moment we're stuck with Euclidean spacetime. I mean, what we can do, we can again throw in the end out the gravity bit and just rotate the standard model. But the problem is really how to formulate the gravitational bit. At the moment, we can't do it. Sorry. What's important here for perhaps to keep in mind as the main idea is that the Dirac operator plays one of the most important roles in this. On the one hand, it gives, as usual, the particle dynamics, but also it encodes the metric of the underlying manifold. So you can reconstruct everything. And the Dirac operator really plays the role of the metric here. The next step, this is a little bit chronological now, was this famous Kohn-Lott model. And this was some sort of standard model version without gravity of the whole bit. And here the spectral triple, I just give you the algebra. The algebra is this famous complex numbers plus quaternions plus 3x3 complex matrices. The Dirac operator is just a fermionic mass matrix. You can do all the geometry as well, or all the theorems hold also for non-commutative algebra. So you don't need commutative algebra as the functions over space-time, but you can also have do all the geometry as non-commutative algebras. Of course, your interpretation of manifold then fails, But the interesting bit is that the automorphism group, so the symmetry group of this algebra, is just U1 times SU2 times SU3, at least when lifted properly to the Hilbert space. And here, in the old days, Conn and Lodges wrote down the non-gravitational forces. They just used the standard model action. But this is not something we would like, because we would like to have everything in a gravitational setting. And here, for the finite bit, the Dirac operator, as I said, plays the role of the fermionic mass matrix. But you also see that the Higgs turns out, which is then encoded in this Dirac operator, turns out to be something like the internal metric of these discrete spaces. So the Higgs pops up here with a real geometric meaning. It's just a connection in this internal space. But if you combine these two, that's was the standard model of Chamsuddin and Common in 1996, you just take the tensor product of these of your normal manifold with this internal space, and you find that your symmetry group is just diffeomorphisms times your standard model gauge group. And if you write the spectral action down for this, you find out, you get out the Einstein-Hilbert action, cosmological constant, standard model action, and some higher curvature terms. And the interesting bit is that here the potential for the Higgs just pops out with the right sign. So you get this Mexican hat potential for free as some sort of Einstein-Hilbert action for this internal space. Yeah. Less than the standard model action. And I will come to this at the end, why there are less parameters. You got 1, 2, 3 extra conditions, so you can. In the end, the interesting parameter you can cut down on is that you can fix the quartic coupling of the Higgs potential at cutoff energy, at a given energy. I will come to that at the end when I tell you some details of the spectral action. No, it's not addressed.
So the Higgs mass is the
Yes, in that sense, yes. But when you know the quartic coupling of the Higgs, you can evolve it at a given energy scale. You can evolve it down with renormalization group flow to, let's say, Z mass. And that's the missing bit you need to fix the Higgs mass. So. A priori, yes, but you can. We did some classifications, and it shows. I won't do this here, but you can. The AF of the standard model seems to be more or less the smallest AF you can choose. So it's more or less the first thing that is consistent with all the axioms of non-commutative geometry. There's not much, you don't have that much freedom. There's some freedom, but there are just a few models, and one of those is a standard model. So it's not like you have in a sense, an infinity of models, but the standard model seems to be one of the smallest. But in an algebraic sense, so no dynamical approach as perhaps a physicist would like it. So just to summarize the almost commutative standard model, what you automatically get is from the action principle, the combined Einstein-Hilbert and standard model of action, a positive cosmological constant, the Higgs boson with a correct quartic Higgs potential. I think that's the most stunning bit. And the Dirac operator then plays a multiple role as Higgs and gauge bosons. They are in this finite part. And in the manifold part, gives you particle dynamics, Fermi mass matrix, and it gives you a metric for the manifold and for this internal space. So now a little bit more serious for the geometry, the basics. I just rush you through it and won't go into any details. What you need as ingredients for a spectral triple is five things. So don't ask me why it's still called a spectral triple. what you need first, you need a real associative unital pre-C star algebra. You saw one, which is this function algebra over the manifold. The other one is, for example, these matrix algebras or tensor products of this. Yeah, you need a Hilbert space on which this algebra is faithfully represented. The interesting bit is this representation also determines induces the representations of your automorphisms, so of your symmetry group. So, and since algebra representations are far more restrictive than group representations, you're essentially left with fundamental representations of your gauge groups. So there's not so much space. You wouldn't have anything like SU2 triplets or whatever.
So one of the ad hoc properties of the standard model, eventually one, is that you have to assume the H field is a hex transform as an isotope.
Yes. Here it's.
You can also transform as an isotope.
Yeah.
Isotope plus isotope also. It's an assumption.
Yes. And here it's, you have a doublet, and that's it. If it's SU2, it's a doublet. No triplets, no n-plets, no whatever. You're stuck with fundamental and adjoint representation, and that's it. And that's because the algebra, the representation of a group comes from the algebra representation. Algebra representations don't admit tensor products. You're there with a fundamental, and that's it.
So is there a simple answer to why there is a Higgs and a doublet of SU2 and not a Higgs and a triplet of SU3?
There is an answer, but not a simple answer. The point is, if you look at how these, what is the representation of the algebra which works with all the axioms and everything so that you have good geometry, you find that the SU3 for the particle configuration of the standard model has to couple vectorially. And so will in any case commute with the Dirac operator and so with the Higgs, and so the Higgs can't be charged under the SU3. So here it is, if it's an outcome, yes, in a way, yes, as an outcome is because the algebra commutes with the Dirac operator, and in the Dirac operator you have the Higgs field, and so because everything couples vectorially, you.
Right, but so maybe when you have some different methods, but from a naive point of view, you would seem that you have the complex numbers times the complex 2x2 matrices times the complex 3x3 matrices, 2x2 matrices and 3x3 matrices play the same role. And so why it is that the linear geometry is something that represents a scalar field that's charged under the SU2, but there is no object that's charged under the SU3.
Here it's because of the representation isn't just that straightforward here.
Is that a choice that you made to get the standard model to come out? That is, that SU3 was
No. If you look at the classification, you see that you don't have actually that much of a choice. So no, it's. I think it's not a choice. No, here it's not really. You could have other scalar fields which couple to the SU3, so which would be some SU3 Higgses. I assume if you enlarge the fermionic space and put in more particles, but for the standard model Higgs, you're really here stuck with.
Then you're saying the answer is yes. That is, if in nature there was a color triplet of scalar fields, then you could have a color triplet of scalar fields.
Depends to which fermions this color triplet would couple. I don't know if it would work for any triplet. So there are probably many constraints on this color triplet then, coming from the representation, everything. You couldn't just throw in anything. And so, and what you need also, as I said, is a Dirac operator, which is here just a self-adjoint operator on this Hilbert space with a compact resolvent. And you need an anti-unitary operator J, so here we go beyond triplets, which the mathematicians call the real structure. For physicists, it just turns out to be the charge conjugation operator. And you need an anti-unitary operator, which is called here gamma, which turns out to be just the chirality operator. So what the mathematicians found here is just operators we know in physics for quite a while. We have in the spectral triple, I tell you just quickly because in recent papers that was quite an issue, with two notions of dimension. On the one hand, the usual metric dimension, which is associated with the eigenvalues of the Dirac operator. But there's also some dimension called the KO dimension, somewhere deep from K theory, where I can't tell you much about because I don't understand it, to be honest. This is associated to the real structure and the chirality and the commutation relations among them. Usually, one takes these two dimensions to be equal, but it turns out for these internal spaces, they have zero metric dimension. It turns out that it's better to take for this KO dimension 6 instead of 0, whereas for the usual manifold, one takes 4, so both would be four-dimensional. There's another unitary operator epsilon in the zero-dimensional case if this KO dimension is also 0, but this is the detail. I think I was already too slow. For the axioms or conditions for non-commutative geometry, which you then need to recover your usual differential calculus, you need to assume a classical dimension n. As I said, the dimensional metric dimension comes in through the asymptotic behavior of the eigenvalues of the Dirac operator via a theorem of Hermann-Weyl. Here we have to assume that we have natural number n as a dimension. It can be zero, but it should be a natural number and no fractional dimension or something like that. We need a second condition called regularity, which just tells us that the algebra elements are differentiable in a generalized sense. Finiteness axiom, which tells us that the Hilbert space is generated finitely. First order of the Dirac operator, also in an algebraic version, which tells us that the Dirac operator is a first order operator. We need to put in Poincaré duality axiom so that Poincaré duality holds and we can integrate. We want orientability. And last thing is the reality. And here this KO dimension pops in. And this just tells you how the real structure and your chirality operator commute or anti-commute in zero metric dimension or in zero metric dimension. So they either commute or anti-commute. This turned out to be quite important because if you choose KO dimension 6 for this internal space, you can have Majorana masses for your neutrinos, which are prohibited if you choose KO dimension 0. But I won't go further into the details. And now there is the reconstruction theorem of Kohn. I put in a very sloppy version that a compact Riemannian spin manifolds are equivalent to spectral triples with a commutative. And I put the little twiddles here because there is now a proof of Kohn, which came out just a few months ago to the theorem. But I think it's not yet approved by the mathematical community. It's quite a thick thing, 60 or 80 pages. And people are working through it in seminars, as far as I know. Usually, the proof is the proof works well if you start out with a compact Riemannian four-dimensional spin manifold. You can write down the spectral triple, and you get back and forth without a problem. It's just when these algebras are quite pathological, there arise subtle mathematical problems, as far as I know, and that's why the proof, the rigorous proof, is quite involved and very difficult. There were many failures.
Space-time nature is not a
compact population of dimension. No, the Riemannian is the Euclidean problem I already mentioned, and whether it's compact or not, I think it's.
I guess what's equal is not a locally, not a compact group, but a large group. So if you look at the.
But we look here at the diffeomorphisms, and the local group is here SO4. And but we don't know. I don't know if anybody knows whether space-time is a compact manifold. I mean, the universe could be well compact.
So this is where that, I mean,
Yeah, and I guess you could. There are generalizations for locally compact spaces. So I guess one could go. One could do that as well. But for the moment, we stick with a compact order.
GL4 from the heart is general formulation. It's not a compact group.
Yeah, but
this is not the definition of compact. This is just the standard definition of is the manifold compact or not.
Yeah.
It's not the this is not the structure group.
No. No, just the manifold.
The compact, which
I mean
not a which is a model, it's not space time presumably is not compact.
Yeah. But I mean, that's for here, that's our space-time model we work on. Because, I mean, the main problem is really we have to work in a Euclidean space for the moment. That's really what bothers me most at the moment, but I don't have a solution. For these finite spectral triples, the easiest thing to have in non-commutative algebra is, of course, to have some matrix algebra, so the sum of matrices. And the interesting bit for physicists is, of course, that the automorphisms of these algebras are just UNs, or if you have here quaternions, it's just SU2. For the finite Hilbert space, this is just a C to the N, where N is in the total number of particles, so left, right, and particle, anti-particles counted separately. And the internal Dirac operator is then, as I said, just the fermionic mass matrix. These commutation relations and axioms, they put strong constraints on it and restrictions on the Dirac operator on the Hilbert space. I just the first thing you see is that the Hilbert space actually splits in four parts: so left right particle, left right antiparticle. And the Dirac operator always takes this form, where you have here your normal Dirac operator, and then here a symmetric matrix where, if allowed, Majorana masses would sit in. So, and then these almost commutative geometries, that's tensor products of space-time spectral triple and these finite spectral triples. So we just take here four-dimensional compact manifold, as I said, for space-time. And for the internal bit, just one of these matrix algebras. And the point is you really can take tensor product. Everything works fine. For the Dirac operator, you have to be a bit careful, since it has to stay first-order operator. But you just take this linear combination. And what comes out is then that the automorphism group of this thing would be just the diffeomorphism group of your manifold with semidirect product with the automorphism group of this internal space. And then you have to pick or deduce somehow the correct internal space and hope that you and find the standard model, hope that you find the standard model. That's a bit tricky, but in the axioms you have there relations among how the commutation relations and all that. And then you just have to find the minimal dimension by hand, you brute calculation. I don't know what, if A was a Hopf. Hopf algebras are usually not associative, are they? But there are, I mean, I don't. I know that for these SUQ2 quantum groups, people have done the calculation. These are these they are closely related to these non-commutative spheres. Gianni Landi and André Zita is also there. They have done many calculations, but apparently nothing of direct physical interest came out yet. So I don't know. Try some more complicated Hopf algebra, but it's generally quite difficult to write down proper spectral triple. So and perhaps to keep a for a picture in mind, these almost commutative geometries, they look almost like Kaluza-Klein spaces. So this is some easy drawing of Kaluza-Klein space with these little spherical dimensions attached to each point. And the idea would somehow be to exchange these little circles with some finite space. And then you have these dotted lines. So each finite space is then attached to each point. And the point is because here you have finite spaces, you don't have these towers of particles as in Kaluza-Klein spaces, because finite spaces just emit finite number of particles. So that's how you avoid a Kaluza-Klein tower. So now we have some geometry, and we want, of course, to do some physics. And the first thing we have to notice is that if we write down a Dirac operator like this, we don't have gauge bosons or Higgs boson involved. And even more, it's just a fermionic mass matrix, so there are just numbers in. So if we would write down a fermionic action, it wouldn't even be gauge invariant. So what Kahn came up with is what he calls fluctuating the Dirac operator. I would also call it just gauging the Dirac operator. So what you do is you fluctuate the Dirac operator with lifted automorphisms. You have to define how to lift the automorphisms of your algebra to the Hilbert space. This is just another way of writing that is in the adjoint, that the automorphisms are represented in an adjoint representation. And if you gauge or fluctuate the Dirac operator then with this lift, you find that it's just the old Dirac operator plus gauge potentials or one form. And then you just do the old trick of Einstein. You promote these fixed or these gauge fields with curvature zero to general gauge fields. And in this way, you obtain the normal gauge potentials and also the Higgs potential. Yes, for the gauges, but I thought in the sense of that Einstein did in general relativity. Okay. So just a little detail how you do it. If this is your combined Dirac operator here, you find that in the first bit, if you fluctuate this, you get the gauge bosons. I put the curvature here in brackets and also here the automorphism of this algebra, because this part is not understood yet. So nobody, or we don't know how normal curvature, so a spin connection or something like that, comes into play via fluctuations. The only thing you can do, you can write down the Dirac operator, which also has already has spin connection. So you put curvature just in. The lift is almost unique. Yeah, it's not unique in the U1s. There you have to do a central extension, and there you have central charges which are not unique. And you usually fix them by requiring that there is no that there are no harmful anomalies, so no U1 anomalies. But in this sense, it is not unique. The U1s are they have a certain freedom to choose. That's something we try to do at the moment in Potsdam, to formulate everything for the first place just with principal bundles, normal fields, and everything, and then see how far you go there without.
No.
That's just a technique. But I
often emphasize that.
Yeah, I'm. I don't know if that's something I don't know yet. I don't know if it works, for example, with the generalized Dirac operators of Gromov-Lawson. That could be. So, but I'm not sure yet if everything, if you can have a Higgs boson in this way, because this is This Dirac operator con calls is a Dirac operator, but I'm not sure yet how it really relates to the standard Dirac operator you find in Gorhanov Lawson's papers or Lawson-Michaels or in these general where they act on principal bundles with associated vector bundles or whatever. So not sure yet, but could be.
Is this X boson elementary spin zero plus particle, is it copper?
No, it's elementary. Here it's elementary.
Is it getting elementary particle fluctuating?
Yes. Yeah, it's an SU2 elementary SU2 doublet here, and a scalar.
Because normally it's just right there in the action.
Yeah, and
textbooks.
Yeah.
It's a classical action. You throw in the scalar.
Yes, and we don't throw it in.
That's better practice.
It's just first of all, it comes out here as a connection or as the gravitational field of this internal space. And if you just write down the Einstein or the equivalent to the Einstein-Hilbert action for the Dirac operator, which would be then, or Euclidean Einstein-Hilbert action, which would be the spectral action I'm coming to in a minute. If you do the same thing with this generalized Dirac operator, you just get out S Einstein-Hilbert action for this internal space, the correct Higgs potential. So that's something that just comes out. So the Higgs has a completely natural interpretation here. It's just the gravitational connection for the internal space. And it's encoded in the Dirac operator, in the generalized Dirac operator. So I wouldn't say it's you stick it in here. I would say it comes out. So for the bosonic action, this is the spectral action of Conor Chamsuddin from mid-90s. It's defined, you need a diffeomorphism or an automorphism invariant action. And the simplest thing you can write down is just the number of eigenvalues of this fluctuated Dirac operator up to a cutoff lambda. So what you get is an effective action. Here you already see why this is problematic when you go to Lorentzian, because then you don't know how to count eigenvalues up to a cutoff. What does this mean? It wouldn't be a Lorentz invariant quantity. Secondly, if you don't have a compact manifold, your eigenvalues wouldn't be countable, but you would just have continuum, and you wouldn't have eigenvalues. So this action seems to be made for the Euclidean compact case, but I've talked to mathematicians, and they told me, especially Adam Rennie, that you probably can do something like that even in Lorentzian space and even in the non-compact case via local index theorems. But I don't know yet how that should work. Yeah.
So is it time to start counting parameters?
Yes.
The action looks very simple, but you have a free function.
Yes. Yes. I count for you the parameters in a second. Exactly. This is a positive test function to have a mean to count these eigenvalues, yes, but it only comes in via its momenta. So, and the only momenta which count here are the first three. So you have from the test function, you just get three numbers. That's everything that's left. And to calculate this action, you actually do a heat kernel expansion.
You take the first three terms of the heat kernel expansion.
Yes.
And they have three coefficients.
Yes, I'll give you the heat kernel expansion detail in a second. Just quickly, the fermionic action, you just take the scalar product on the Hilbert space and stick in the fluctuated Dirac operator. There is a tiny difficulty here because you overcount the fermionic degrees of freedom. Because if you look at the tensor product of the two parts of the Hilbert space, you have left, right in the already in the manifold bit, and you have the same left-right antiparticle structure in the internal bit. So if you do the tensor product, you get four times too many terms here. So you have to project out later on the physical bits.
What makes the fermions fermions?
Yeah, that's what you have to do later. At the moment, it's just elements of a spin or a Hilbert space. And then if you go further, you have to for the yeah. Then you have to introduce.
It.
Yes, you have to do later.
It's not well established. No, it's a fact because the material has a mass.
Yes.
So the original standard one is no longer being realized. And so the whole thing has become ad hoc in the last 3 or 4 years. What do you produce here? Zero mass neutrinos?
Actually, the neutrino mass bit is a subtle thing. You can have Majorana masses. And so you have, on the one hand, the usual Dirac mass term for left-hand doublet, right-handed neutrino. And you can also have Majorana masses, which couple right-handed neutrino to right-handed antineutrino. And then, of course, you have the problem with non-renormalizability. But I mean, the whole thing is classical. We don't talk about renormalizability. What we...
Why is not renormalized?
Yeah, because if you have a right-handed neutrino with mass, and in order to write down a equation, you need five six dimensional operators. But these are proofs. Also, you violate electron number. So you have to have
I won't go into that discussion. I won't go into that discussion. So yes, you can have right-handed neutrinos, you can have Majorana masses, and you can have lots of problems. So, now coming to the real standard model, I just give you for the basics for the internal bit of the spectral triple. You have your algebra, which is C plus H plus M3 of C. There is another version which with an extra C, but this is also a technicality I won't go into here. The automorphism group of this is just SU2 times U3, or the non-commutative bit. The C turns out to be just some sort of receptacle where you stick in U1s later. And then when you lift that with the lift I showed you before, it turns out that the U3 reduces to an SU3, and you get an extra, and you get the U1 out there, which is then pops up at the right places for the standard model. For the internal Hilbert space, you just choose the Hilbert space for the minimal standard model, or you can also put in right-handed neutrinos. The right-handed neutrinos don't seem to be minimal. In the minimal standard model, you can't take anything out without destroying the axioms of the spectral triples. But any time you pick out one particle, one quark, or the electron, everything breaks down. And in that sense, I think the standard model is really a minimal model in this picture. Right-handed neutrinos don't seem to be minimal. You can put them in or leave. That's seems from the algebraic point of view, it seems to be a matter of choice. As I said, for the internal Dirac operator, you take the fermionic mass matrix, and you see that you also have these. If you put it in, you see that you can also have the CKM matrix, mixing matrix for neutrinos, and Majorana masses and seesaw mechanism. You can have them for right-handed neutrinos. So these mass terms are allowed.
And so we may be giving you too hard of a time, but if your claim is to really explain the standard model, this is why we're asking many questions.
Yeah.
So for example, if you just had one generation of fermions.
Each we can't explain the number of generation. Each generation can stand for itself and is a proper spectral triple. You can have any number of generations. We have no handle on the number of generations, unfortunately. So. I come in a second. That's just the next slide, I hope. Yes. If you do this heat kernel expansion, that's what you get. These Fs here are just the moments of the test function. So you have here the fourth moment, second moment. Oh, no. This is the way con. This is the first moment, this is the second moment, this is the third moment. here, this cutoff pops in, and here's some numerical factors. So, what you see, you have to begin with at the cutoff, you have a cosmological constant term, which is huge at the cutoff because it turns out later that this cutoff is almost Planck mass. So, you start with a huge cosmological constant. But actually, I don't think that is a problem. Because there are some ideas for exact renormalization group flows for also gravity of the Mainz group and Akachi and Martin Reuter, which also start with a huge cosmological constant, which then evolves down due to renormalization flow to tiny cosmological constants. So that might even be a good feature here. You have here your Einstein-Hilbert bit, and then you have to identify this with a Planck mass. And now comes the standard model. Here you have the square term, which is also, at least in the normal standard model, could be a very huge term here with these lambda squares. So it doesn't solve at all this hierarchy problem. This A is just it's just a function of the trace of the internal Dirac operator squared. So this is one free parameter you have. For the quartic term, you have the fourth momentum of the test function with another function, which is just, trace of the Dirac operator through 4. And then you have here the kinematical bit. You have the what you also get is a coupling between the curvature scalar and the Higgs field. By here is the Higgs field, and that turns out to be just 1/12th here, so just what you would expect with conformal coupling. And here you see that for the three gauge fields, here's the SU2, U1 gauge field, SU3 gauge field. These rows here are just numerical factors you get from the representation. For the standard model, they all turn to be out just the number of generations you have. So it's just 3. But you see that they all come with the same pre-factor, with the same. So what you have is something like in grand unified theories, that all the gauge couplings at this given cutoff should be the same. There is a subtlety that you have an extra due to the choice in the central extension when lifting the gauge group. You have an extra degree of freedom in here. So what you can say is that at the cutoff, the SU3 and the SU2 coupling should be equal. And then you have an extra term here with a higher derivative curvature. This is y squared, and this is just the Euler effect. And to fix these couplings, or to see how it comes, what you do, you redefine your Higgs field, and you do it in a way that this term, the kinematical term for the nu phi, becomes the standard 1/2 e mu phi squared. And you redefine this Higgs field. You redefine this to become your normal lambda over 24, or I don't know, lambda half, whatever you prefer for your quartic bit. And if you redefine also, and then you see that these couplings here have to be they should be equal to 1 over g, the g squares. And also you find that if you take the sum over the fermionic bit here, this should be the sum over all fermions with psi and just the Higgs bit, so just the U-cover couplings, and you put in this redefinition. And if you put all this together, because everywhere the only real degree of freedom you have is this F0 here. This pops up everywhere. It just ties you together all the possible couplings. And what you get is this constraint here, Atlas couple, that G2 equals G3. And these two equal 3 times sum over all your cover couplings squared over all your cover couplings to the fourth power, and then little lambda from the quartic coupling. And this equals also the sum over all your cover couplings squared. And this equalities reduce effectively the number of couplings. And this they tie together via this F0, so the fourth momentum of the S function. Yes.
Most of them have to do with each mass as a
cupping
cost. Are you planning to predict all the masses?
No, just the sum of the U cover couplings. You can choose the masses in there freely as long as you don't overdo it. So yes, in a way, yes. But just as the sum of all mass, all your cover couplings and at a cutoff. And you'll see that it turns out to work pretty well.
Is it the sum of the masses or the Cox and the four Cox and
Yeah, this is just the sum of the U-cover couplings. And you say, what we claim is that this should be equal to here 4 times. I mean, the 3 goes away if you take 3 generation of the standard model, 4 times G2 squared. And if you add up all the U-cover couplings of the standard model, that's approximately where you end up. You need a little bit more, actually. Actually, the standard model particles don't have enough. So that's why you need probably heavy right-handed Higgs particles. So you probably need a Majorana mass and a Cesor mechanism to have neutrinos with a mass roughly of order top, or with a U-cover coupling with of the same order of the top U-cover coupling, which then reduces later through the Cesor mechanism to some tiny neutrino. No, not yet. No. For the moment, for the standard model, we don't predict anything new, or you call right-handed neutrinos new particles, or yeah, okay, then we predict, then we would require new particles. Yeah. for me, right-handed, perhaps I'm younger, for me, right-handed neutrinos are already included into the standard model. Since I'm doing this, they're there. So, and the question is now, if you stick in here is a standard model, experimental values, what you know. So what you put in here in this model is, first of all, one has to underline, it's you put in the big desert. So you in this model, we say there's a standard model, right-handed neutrinos, and nothing else. And then G2 and G3, you put in the experimental values at the Z mass. Yeah, you put in the U-cover coupling or the mass of the top neutrino and neglect all the other the top quark and neglect all the other quarks because they are comparatively light. And you also have to stick in that the heaviest light left-handed or the heaviest neutrino seems to be around something like a third of an electron volt if neutrino oscillation gives us the right estimate. And then you see for this, I mean, you evolve everything with a renormalization group flow. You see that at 1 to the 17 GeV, G2 equals G3. I mean, that's well known. Then you determine with this little lambda via these equations we had just the page before, you evolve little lambda down the other way, and you find that the Higgs mass should be roughly about 1.6 GeV. And for the neutrino, you see with the top Yukawa coupling that the neutrino Yukawa coupling could be roughly 1.3 of the top Yukawa coupling, and you should have a Majorana mass of 10 to the 13 GeV to get roughly this at the end of the neutrino.
The latest temperature result.
Yes, that's what I just wanted to.
August 28th.
Yes.
I've excluded the Higgs mass.
For the 90.
170 plus or minus 5 GeV.
I know.
To 3 sigma.
Yes, I know.
It's the only ones actually excluded. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it's irony. But I mean, the main point here is. We stuck in this, the big desert. So the question is now, of course, can we go beyond the standard model? So does it need to be this minimal setup? But yeah.
Two questions. Are there these one loop or two loop?
One loop.
So things can change. Things did change in the.
Things can change. And also, there is this conformal coupling term. And. This has not been included, so I don't know how this. So.
What was the fudge about the U1 coupling? Because of course, I mean, there's a standard story that the U1 coupling doesn't unify, and you had some sort of fudge. You said that there's a free parameter that sneaks in.
Yes, the U1. Or the way I see it, the U1 coupling comes in through a central extension, and it's just the determinant of the U3 from the color. That's the U1 that comes in and then has to be put in via central extension. But then you can choose the central charge, because it's up to you what you call a one electron charge. So you have a free parameter there. And that's a free parameter which comes in then in this place and leaves you just enough space to get the right G1. Because otherwise, if you would fix that to one, for example, then you would get these famous 5/3 G1 squared equals G2 squared and so on. So, and that doesn't work. But luckily, there is one other free parameter which you can use to get the right proportion to fix the G1 also at the same cutoff.
Just let's save it for the end, so we have we're almost there.
Actually, I am there. So just conclusions, or I think I let you draw the conclusions. I'd rather put on a to-do list. And first thing, models beyond the standard model, LHC signature, dark matter, whatever. And now the Tevatron data, of course, it seems to exclude the 170 GeV also, although I have asked some people working at Z0, and they told me to be patient. It's 95% confidence level, which could still be there or around there. So, and on the other hand, we're extrapolating over several orders of magnitude. So I wouldn't take our error bars too seriously. Perhaps there's a 10 plus minus 10 GeV in it. And if you take second order perturbation theory or third order, values might change. I think it's just for the pure standard model, if this is correct and non-commutative geometry is correct, then we would opt for a heavy Higgs. That's, I think, the lesson one could learn. But
I don't want to interrupt. Let's get this cleared up. Okay? If the Higgs mass goes above 800 GeV, you wipe the whole thing for experiment.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about 800.
You can't get too big.
Yeah, but I'm talking about 180, 90, 160, 70, and not 800. but not 120. That's the point, I guess.
Because if you take, as an orbis, if you take the top mass, which is not an order 0.76, and you plot it versus W, W mass versus top, and the tetratron shows that the, if the electron big model is the same one is correct, then each mass has the likely law 150 GeV.
Yes, but there are also these other measurements with the, what's it called, back-forward asymmetry, which favors a Higgs mass of something like 400 with a lower bound of 180 GeV. So there are large discrepancies as well as in the theory. So I just say what comes out and I wait for the experiment. So. So just mechanisms for neutrino masses is still there's still some work to do here. Dirac neutrinos, Majorana neutrinos. If you have Majorana neutrinos there are some subtle problems with the orientability axiom. So it doesn't fit too well. So when I'm currently looking for some different mechanisms to circumvent this. Renormalization group flow, as I said, for all couplings in the spread collection, and there is an idea to use these exact renormalization groups in the spirit of Martin Reuter. To understand these fluctuations with the diffeomorphism group, this is far from clear. That's something we try to do in Potsdam with the mathematicians at the moment. Big issues, spectral triples with Lorentzian signature, as I said. Adam Rennie, Mario Paschke, and Rainer Fercher working on this, and they are promising some results. Well, they are promising them some time now. And, well, an action principle for the Lorentzian signature. There are also some ideas, local index fermions, as I said, and these still don't know how to pronounce his name. I have never met him, so I couldn't ask him how to pronounce him. Jürgen Tolstorff has worked on these, and I think they have also done it in Lorentzian signature and got out some interesting results. And in the end, if you want to read a little bit on this, I mean, there's like very short excerpt from the bibliography. I think the easiest accessible thing at the moment is still this old paper of Mashuka. Yeah, thank you, Mel. Thank you.
Has anybody tried to play this game with grand implications, say, 10-dimensional low vector spaces with stochastic?
Yes, Ali Shamsuddin tried that, but up to now, when we did this classification, we looked at models which had just one matrix algebra. What just one summand in the matrix algebra, just some n by n matrix, and then un or so or on or whatever gauge group. And the funny bit is the minimum of the Higgs potential seem to be always completely degenerate in the sense that all the masses of the particles seem to be equal then, or are equal. So it doesn't seem to be possible with a spectral action to get then, non-degenerate masses. And so, and Ali Shamsuddin, as I said, he tried without a real result. Maybe possible, but up to now there's no viable model. Well,
we don't find any new particles below 7 TeV, which is, say, 14 TeV is the total energy machine, 7 TeV center of mass. What would this do for your model?
I think for...
What is ever observed? An elementary spin zero particle with positive charge. Neither in condensed matter physics or in elementary particles. I don't believe that Higgs particle exists.
Okay, if the Higgs particle.
I'm joining Stephen Hawking at BBC. I'm waiting to put in $100.
So if the Higgs particle doesn't exist, first thing, I think this breaks down. Second thing, I think, is I'll go into management consulting and earn and three times as much as at the moment.
There's no way to manage planet.
Any other comments, questions?
So what is the intuition of the properties of the Stanford particles for the effective and human Lorentzian model? Do you have any clue?
I hope nothing changes. Or but no, I don't. Since my only clue is that these people around Jürgen Tolksdorf, they wrote down, they did in a way what you proposed. They wrote down a Dirac operator for a generalized bundle. So they and then did this in the Lorentzian. Used these residuals to calculate as an action functional, and they got pretty much the same results here as here. So this is for me a hint of hope that it also would work in the Lorentzian setting. But as I said, I don't know how to do the Lorentzian setting. It's quite speculative. The masses of, for example, the mass of the Higgs particle seems to be they have a little bit, they have a wider range, but they did the calculations a little bit different. So they had a range of around 170 plus minus 20. So that's also why I would say this rather heavy range of a Higgs would be preferred. I don't know. Probably also depends how you, if you have to go beyond the standard model to put in more fermions, that would come back to these relations, to these equations which relate the different coupling constants, and that would probably change the Higgs mass also. In fact, we have one model where you put in something like quarks, but with a different with a new color group. And they change the Higgs mass quite drastically up. So you get something like 250, 260. Only problem is that these particles have something about 60, 70 GeV as a mass. And I think they should be excluded. I asked people, experimentalists working at Tevatron, and they said, well, we haven't looked for that. They could have disappeared in the binning. We don't know. So that, I found that a little bit discouraging. I hope they could say no, yes or no, but they didn't want to say anything.
Is the simplest thing would be to put in the fourth generation and just assume it's neutrinos with
mass? Yeah.
Do you then get some relationship between the neutron atmospheric and the Higgs?
Yes, actually Thomas Schücker and Mark Knecht did this in a paper, and they found out that it's not compatible. So that has, if you do this here, you need particles, because just the space of or what you have left for U-covered couplings from this relation is almost used up. You can't do much more. As I said, if you do put these new particles, these quark-like particles to it, you get something of the order of 60 GeV, and so you would expect quarks or electron of fourth generation quarks, electrons of order 50, 60, 70 GeV, and they are excluded experimentally. So you couldn't put it in as a fourth generation. That's not an option, that's for sure.
Right, so